don't think anybody in the community would vote to raise their taxes to save the just legal.
After almost 100 years, an iconic former children's home in Seward is closer than ever to being torn down. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a potential buyer for the controversial Anchorage LIO building.
We see this as a prime real estate, so we jumped on it. We want to see it as earning some revenue for ACDA.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
A piece of Alaska history is deteriorating in Seward, and the nonprofit group trying to protect it says time is running out. The Jesse Lee Home is a nearly century-old former children's home and the birthplace of the Alaska state flag. The nonprofit Friends of the Jesse Lee Home had millions in grants and more than a decade to fix it up. But state officials say the group mismanaged state funds. Now, as Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove reports, the home is closer than ever to being torn down.
It's pouring rain, and Doreen Lorenz holds an umbrella as we walk through the gate to the Jesse Lee Home property.
The city of Seward fenced it off a couple years ago just to keep vandals out.
Lorenz chairs the Friends of the Jesse Lee Home with hopes to restore this place to something at least close to its former glory and transform it into a state-owned magnet school. Right now, though, the enormous building is abandoned and kind of scary looking. It sits on a hill above Seward covered in weathered beige stucco. There are no window panes nor a fully functional roof. But Lorenz says, don't let that fool you. There's plenty here that's worth saving.
It's a stout, sturdy building, and it really is a testament to the engineering, the quality of the materials, and the quality of the guys who built it.
This was a home and school for hundreds of children from 1926 to 1964. Most were Alaska Native kids displaced from tuberculosis and flu-ravaged villages. Famously, a 13-year-old Aleutic boy named Benny Benson won a statewide contest to design Alaska's flag while living at the home. This became the first place to ever fly it. That's just one part of the rich history that the Friends of the Jesse Lee Home want to preserve. And past legislatures have agreed. Lawmakers have appropriated roughly $7 million in grants to restore the building and plan a new school. There's been an architectural study, curriculum development, and some structural reinforcement work. But after more than a decade, there's still rainwater pouring into parts of the building and smashed asbestos tiles strewn around. So what went wrong?
It's so complicated, and it's frustrating as all get out, because if it was up to me, this building would be done by now.
The project does seem complicated. Lorenz says the nonprofit needed to develop school curriculum to know how certain rooms would be used before remodeling them. She also blames Alaska's economic downturn, lean state budgets in recent years, and unfair scrutiny from Governor Bill Walker's administration.
Unfortunately, since the Walker administration, we haven't been able to access funds. We used to go every spring and batten it back down. We did that for several years and did a really good job of keeping the building dry, but we haven't been able to do it for years.
That part about not being able to access funds, it's something Lorenz has said in two recent TV news stories and several times on her group's Facebook page, imploring supporters to call or write their legislators. She's leaving out a key detail, though.
Well, the grants are actually terminated. They were terminated for cause in July of 2015.
That's Fred Parody with the Department of Commerce, the agency that was overseeing the grants.
We just had a series of reporting issues and accountability issues back and forth between us and the Friends of Jesse Lee Home. Disallowed or questionable costs that were identified, and it became clear that the process wasn't working and we needed to terminate the grant, so we did.
The termination letter says, quote, it has become painfully apparent this project will not be successful. It points to nearly $700,000 in improperly documented spending and lists expenses on travel and a film festival, as well as alcohol, an office remodel, and stereo equipment that was sent to a home address. Lorenz has explanations for some of the spending, and she says an audit later found some of the expenses to be justified. But when I asked her about the state's broader claims, we ended up going back and forth about it for about 15 minutes.
I can't give you an explanation for this because no explanation was given to me on why before, for years, everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, it's not fine. And not only is it not fine today, but it's not fine in the past either.
Parity with the state admits the scope of the grant agreements allowed for more than just construction costs. And to be clear, he doesn't think anybody stole money. But Parity says the Friends of the Jesse Lee Home might have gotten off track with developing school curriculum before fixing the deteriorating building. And he says terminating a grant is rare. The department has hundreds of grantees across the state.
There's only a handful that are really troubled, and this is one of them. Reports were late, they were incomplete, they were internally contradictory, they were duplicative. It took us quite a while to sort it out.
Meanwhile, the building itself is at risk. I mentioned asbestos earlier. Removing that is one of several things the nonprofit promised to have done by next summer. If it doesn't complete that checklist, the city of Seward will take ownership of the building, and city officials have said they might have to tear it down. Seward Mayor David Squires says the city simply doesn't have the resources to deal with it. I asked him if that means, as the city manager has suggested, that the city would have no choice but to demolish the Jesse Lee home.
They would have a choice. You can raise taxes up to save it.
Do you think that's likely, though?
No. I don't think anybody in the community would vote to raise their taxes to save the Jesse Lee home. I could be wrong, but I don't see that happening.
Squires says the city has no official position on what should happen to the building. After all, they don't own it. Not yet, anyway. But Seward also got the legislature to take the remaining $1 million from the nonprofit's locked-up grant money and set it aside for the city instead. Lorenz, with the Friends of the Jesse Lee Home, worries this has doomed the restoration project. She says if the building is lost, a physical piece of Alaska's short history and reminder of how the state cared for hundreds of children in need goes with it. In Seward, I'm Casey Grove.
Emergency rooms in Anchorage hospitals cannot keep up with growing numbers of patients needing psychiatric care. It's a problem that's pushing people experiencing acute mental crisis into more traditional ERs, overburdening staff, delaying care to other patients, and straining an already thin system. Devin Kelly is a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News, and she wrote recently that patients staying in the ER longer than 20 hours went from 450 to 700 in 1 year. She says her reporting found several causes.
The big one is that there has been a nursing shortage at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So only about 2/3 of the beds at that hospital are being used. And that has created a bottleneck where people are staying in the emergency room longer because there's no place for them to go next. And so between July of last year and January of this year, the Providence Psychiatric Emergency Room went from telling police and paramedics that they had reached basically unsafe levels to continue receiving new psychiatric patients. It was about 52 hours of being on that status last July, and it went to more than 300 hours in January. And what happens in that case is Providence can't legally turn anyone away, but they're telling people that are driving the ambulances that if there's any way to take a patient to Alaska Regional, to Alaska Native Medical Center, then that would be preferable at that point.
20 hours seems like a long time to be in the ER, and some of these patients are there for days. Talk a little about the strain that this creates for hospital staff and other patients.
What I was hearing is that it's very disruptive. The psychiatric emergency room is designed for people specifically, again, who are experiencing that kind of crisis. And the people that are working in the emergency room are trained in that kind of special care and stabilization. The general emergency room is really for all kinds of emergencies. If you break your leg, you're going to that emergency room. And if you're there with a dozen psychiatric patients who are experiencing a pretty high level of trauma, again, that's just a very disruptive environment from what I was hearing. It also really is a demand on resources. Somebody needs to sit with a psychiatric patient at all hours. Like, it's a 24-hour around-the-clock watching process, and that really takes away a lot of resources from the main emergency room.
Devin, you wrote in your article that the shortage in psychiatric care in Alaska goes back decades, but the problem was exacerbated in 2015. What happened then?
That was when the state could not find enough psychiatrists to work at the psychiatric hospital, API. So there weren't enough people to cover the beds where people were being hospitalized. So they had to reduce the number of beds that were available. And that was the beginning of what's really been an ongoing staffing shortage, as I understand it, and again, has continued to this day and has placed a lot of pressure on the emergency room to hold on to people for longer.
What's happening to address this? Are there things in the works on the state and also the corporate hospital side of the equation to alleviate some of the psychiatric overflow in emergency rooms?
In the very short term, there is state money that is going toward nursing positions and salary increases for nurses at API. Nurses were not really making what was comparable to other hospitals. So they're trying to remedy that situation in hopes of attracting more nurses to working at API and doing what is a challenging job. There's also money going to emergency rooms at hospitals for renovations and security increases, things that are associated with seeing increased number of patients who are experiencing psychiatric conditions. That's on the order of about $10 million between those two things. That was something that the administration of Governor Bill Walker asked for. And then in the next few years, the state is planning on embarking on a wide-ranging overhaul of the way that we do mental health care in the state, and that's something to keep tabs on.
Devin Kelly is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, child care facilities across the state may have trouble adapting to proposed regulations.
Ideally, we would try and balance it without cutting anybody, but $4,000 is a lot of money.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
A downtown office building fraught with political controversy could soon be owned by an Anchorage Development Authority. The glassy modern building at 716 West 4th Avenue was rebuilt at the request of state lawmakers to upgrade the Anchorage Legislative Information Office. But the deal came under criticism, leading to a lawsuit and legislators ultimately abandoning the site in favor of an office suite above a Midtown bank. Now the Anchorage Community Development Authority is seeking to buy the building.
Legally, it's not a done deal.
Melinda Gant is a spokesperson for ACDA, which manages revenues from parking facilities and redevelopment projects for the municipality. Gant says ACDA has been keeping an eye on the vacant property since legislators walked away from it in 2016.
We see this as a prime real estate, so we jumped on it. We want to see it as earning some revenue for ACDA with a tenant that we're going to bring in as market rate.
It's not yet clear who that tenant might be. The building has a unique open design combined with offices that were built specifically to accommodate the needs of the legislature and local constituents. Gant says presently no one is lined up. ACDA agreed to pay $14 million plus closing costs to Everbank, which currently owns the building. That's far below the $37 million price tag lawmakers originally agreed to pay before the sale turned politically toxic. Gant says ACDA is putting down a parking garage on 7th Avenue as collateral and potentially also a parking lot on C Street in order to pay for the new building. But the organization has already made a cash deposit and is aggressively trying to ensure the sale goes through.
The agency could risk losing a deposit, so we are very serious about moving forward with the purchase of this building.
The sale still has to go up for public testimony and be approved by the Anchorage Assembly. Gant estimates that if everything proceeds on time, the deal could be done in 3 months. Flooding that halted Alaska Railroad trains north of Talkeetna on Saturday has receded, but train traffic remains shut down. Railroad spokesman Tim Sullivan says that's because the Susitna River ice jam flooding left behind a mess.
6 to 8 foot high wall of of ice over the course of well over 1,000 feet, maybe close to half a mile of ice that we need to get cleared out of there. And in some places, it has pushed the track off the track bed as far as 25 feet. So our crews are working to get that ice out of there and get the tracks back on the track bed.
Sullivan says the affected area is in the Curry area, about 22 miles north of Talkeetna. He says the goal is to complete cleanup and repairs in time for Wednesday's scheduled start of the railroad's daily summer passenger service between Anchorage, Denali, and Fairbanks.
This window is something we're going to try and take as much advantage of as we possibly can. Get those tracks cleared up and everything back into good shape so we can have our service going on Wednesday.
Sullivan says some cargo scheduled for transport has been shifted to truck.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV.
Proposed regulations may make it harder for child care facilities statewide to do business. KTOO's Edlyn Baxter visited a daycare in Juneau where directors say the new rules would reduce capacity and worsen the shortage of affordable child care.
They're flying a kite. Kite?
Daddy.
Is that a daddy?
In the infant room at Gold Creek Child Development Center, children ranging from 6 weeks through 18 months nap, play, and gurgle under the watchful eye of their teachers. Director Gretchen Boone explains what the impact of one of the proposed regulation changes from the Department of Health and Social Services would be.
This room, we currently have up to 10 children, and we have three teachers. This room would be directly affected by the regulations, and if the age ranges and group sizes changed, we would have to remove or not fill two spaces.
There are 51 pages of changes being proposed to child care center licensing regulations in Alaska. Some are related to compliance with federal child care standards. Others address the types of food child care workers can consume on the job. Gold Creek has 60 children and about 16 staff members. It's one of Juneau's largest child care providers. But the demand is way higher, says Assistant Director Colleen Brody.
We have currently 97 families on our wait list. So we have 51 infants and 46 toddlers on our wait list. And that's a lot of infants and toddlers that don't have care.
The proposed change that most concerns Brody and Boone would lower the maximum group size and child-to-teacher ratio allowed for young toddlers and infants. Gold Creek would lose two spots in both its infant and young toddler rooms. Boone and Brody say losing the tuition from those spots would result in a loss of more than $4,000 in revenue per month, which could force them to cut teacher positions.
Ideally, we would try and balance it without cutting anybody, but $4,000 is a lot of money.
Samantha Adams recently closed her childcare business in Juneau after 12 years due to increasing overhead costs. She says she was losing an average of $30,000 per year.
I'm of the opinion that regulation and oversight is really crucial to ensuring that those programs are keeping kids safe. At the end of the day, I think it's very important to have regulations.
But Adams feels many of the proposed changes overstep. She knows firsthand the financial challenges of running a daycare.
If you're going to implement regulations that limit our ability to make money, absolutely there should be some financial backing for those mandates.
Adams, Boone, and Brody recently signed a statement with a group of eight local child care providers concerned by the proposed changes. They worry many of them could result in the closure of more programs. Adams says she wants providers to have a seat at the table for these decisions.
We as stakeholders in the state of Alaska for the child care workforce, we should be at the table when these are being proposed, before they're ever proposed, before they ever got to public comment. A stakeholder from the profession should be at the table saying, well, here's our perspective or here's our thought. And I think a lot of us were feeling overlooked because they don't do that.
Besides the ratio issues, some providers are concerned about a requirement that center administrators have a certain number of college credits in early childhood education. Providers must have one designated administrator on site for every 30 children. They already need to meet a number of qualifications to be an administrator, and some providers feel mandating more classes adds to the financial strain workers feel in a field that doesn't pay much. The state's Child Care Program Office did not respond to requests for comment on the proposed changes. The public comment period ends May 31st. After that, department officials will decide what, if anything, to change. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
This week, we're sharing stories from the Battle of Attu and the Greater Aleutian Campaign of World War II. The conflict ended in the 1940s, but its legacy is still very much alive, both for the veterans who served and the Unungan people who were forced to leave during the fighting. To commemorate what happened 75 years ago, KUCB invited people on both sides to sit down and reflect together. Today, we hear from Army veteran Paul Shaughnessy, who spent parts of World War II on ADAC, and Martin Oury, who was sent to Seattle after the bombing of Dutch Harbor. A note to listeners, one of the people in this story uses a word that is offensive for Japanese people.
I was 4.5 years old when they bombed Dutch Harbor. We were here when they bombed it. And,
wow. You remember that?
I remember it. Yeah. And I remember planes going over and the place is rocking and guns going off. And my brother ran outside, the older brother, he's 2 years older than I am, and came back in and said, told Mom, you know, Mommy, I see an airplane go over. I could see the man in it, you know.
Did he tell you it was Japanese?
He said it was Jap. My mother was notified to get one suitcase, packed, and she had 25 to 30 minutes to be on board the ship that was in the harbor. The ship turned out to be a troop transport, President Fillmore. And we got on board her, and we ended up in Seattle.
You
we
and
were the lucky ones.
Yeah, I've heard since I've been here, this is for the veterans and the evacuees.
Right.
It's commemorating both of those. And you were technically an evacuee, but you went to Seattle.
The troop transport, I guess. That's where she was going, so that's where they took us. Luckily, we had relatives in Kent, Washington, which is just south of Seattle a little bit. And so we went to Kent for a year or so. And
well, you really get it kind of lucky that you had a place to go there.
Eventually, my father was still up here.
Yeah.
He got a hold of one of my uncles down there, an old Norwegian, Sarah was his name, and told him to find a house for us. And so Sarah found us a house by Green Lake in Seattle, and then my father paid him back for it when he finally came down after they got things going.
I got in the Army late and got up here in January 44 to ADAC, and my wife, she's an Aleutian veteran.
Mm.
I lost nothing by signing on for a year. That way, the regulation said you can't take your dependents with you unless you have a year of service or more. Well, bingo, I signed. I got a year so I could get my dependents. So my wife of 7 days and the rest is absentee, 2 years, so I got her up, and we lived in a Quonset hut on ADAC, and had the kitchen and a bathroom and 2 bedrooms, and then a big.
That was a big Quonset hut.
Well, yeah, it was a regular one.
Yeah, that's right.
And they were nice and tight, and insulated and so forth. We had a year here. And people say, well, how can you marry 73 years now? What do you credit the longevity of your marriage? And I've been thinking about it. That year on ADAC was the first year. She couldn't pick up the phone and say, Mother, do you know what he said to me today? You know, we had to work them out, and we did.
Yeah. I fished out of ADAC.
You did?
Yeah, king crabbed out of ADAC.
And that reminds me of a story. We had these guys go out, not only hunting crab at the right time, but they had geese. And then we'd have a nice something to eat, different than Army food, you know. Well, we hadn't had any like Alaskan Department inspection, and so we did have a guy from the headquarters, you know, this mm-hmm. inspection team's coming out, and they're giving us the inspection, and the guys had been out on hunting and had geese, you know. And we had Captain Buck Slaughter from Virginia, and the Colonel.
Is that a real name now?
Yeah.
Kind of like Daniel Boone, huh?
No. It's Buck Slaughter. That was it. So the inspector goes to the mess hall, opens up the refrigerator, and there are these geese all hanging there. And he says, "Captain, don't you know that's against the regulations of the Alaskan Department to be hunting out here?" And Buck Slaughter, fast thinking, he says, "Well, sir, Colonel," he says, "you know, we got these willy-waws out here. And these geese were flying by, and that willy-waw hit them and bashed them up against the mess hall. And my good mess sergeant here, he grabbed them and had some of his men dress them and put them in the refrigerator." That colonel shook his head, slowly closed the door, and I'm sure he said, "Anybody that comes up with a story that fast, it deserves not to be gigged forever." So that was the last time we heard about the geese in the refrigerator.
Those imperial geese, those come from Japan, so you were shooting Japanese geese.
Oh, good for us.
Yeah, really. No, I shot a bunch of them and took them home. We dressed them and took them home. I put them in the blast freezer, you know, and took them home, and I couldn't give them away. They were so dry.
Oh, well.
Fishy taste. So we've got some very common interests, you know. I didn't know it till, you know, now we're talking about war and so on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've had a lot of, you know, a lot of things in life I really treasure, you might say, you know. Yeah. And I'm sure you have, Paul, too. So.
Oh, I've had...
This is one of them here right now, talking with him.
So. That remembrance was produced by KUCB's Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove in Seward, Zechariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Adeline Baxter in Juneau, and Zoe Sobel and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.